the illusion of the other, the unnoticed leap that changes everything without asking for faith. Artist's note. This is the first book I ever wrote. It was written before the proofs, before the formal papers, before the mathematics, before the kill switches. It was written because the question came first and would not leave. Are we really separate? I could not stop asking. I looked at the world and I saw the damage that one assumption was doing. The assumption that you and I are separate at the most fundamental level. I saw it in cruelty and I saw it in indifference. I saw it in systems that sorted people into saved and unsaved, worthy and unworthy, us and them. And I saw that the sorting always came from the same place. The unexamined belief that the other person is truly other. Everything I wrote after this book was written for one reason only, to strengthen this book's case, to give what is said here, gently, the full weight of physics behind it. But you do not need any of that to read this book. This book stands on its own. It asks you to sit with a question, honestly, and see where it leads. No physics, no equations, no special background, just patience and honesty. If what is said here moves you, the formal work exists. It is published free, forever, at the420code.org. The proofs are there. The mathematics is there. The exact conditions under which every claim dies are there. But this is where it starts. This is the gentle door. Walk through it at whatever pace feels right. Nobody is more special than anyone else. Nobody stands closer to the sun. We are all just grains of sand in the desert. G. Preface. You already know what this book is going to say. Not the details, not the arguments, but the conclusion. You have felt it. In moments of closeness, in moments of stillness, in the rare and disarming experience of looking into another person's eyes and recognizing something that has no name. You felt it, and then you let it go, because the world does not have a place for it, because nothing you were taught gave you the words, because it seemed too simple to be true. This book gives you the words. It examines one assumption, that you and I are separate in the most fundamental sense, and traces what happens when that assumption is questioned, not attacked, not denied, questioned gently, with patience and with care. Nothing here requires rejecting science, common sense, or the ordinary distinctions of everyday life. Bodies remain bodies. People remain people. Differences remain real. What is examined is not whether differences exist, but what they mean. No belief is required. No faith is asked for. No moral commitment is demanded. What is required is honesty, the willingness to look at what you already experience and ask whether it has been telling you something you have not yet taken seriously. If what is described here is seen, nothing more is needed. If not, nothing has been taken from you. Orientation. This is one of the standalone books in the 420 code. It is the gentle door. 5 books, 5 doors, 1 building. The illusion of the other. The gentle door. Heart. Being after religion. The front door. Demolition. Antichristos. The sacred door. Reclamation. The relationship corridor. The personal door, presence, the interior, the operational door, construction. This book has 10 chapters. They build on one another. Each follows from the one before it. Chapter 1 starts where everyone already stands with the feeling of being separate and asks whether that feeling is the final truth or a useful tool we forgot was a tool. Chapters 2 through 4 trace what happens when separateness is treated as fundamental, what it costs, how it scales, and how it became embedded in the most powerful institutions on Earth. Chapters 5 through 7 build the alternative, not as theory, but as a recognition. Unity and difference. The individual. Freedom and responsibility. Chapters 8 through 10 draw the conclusion. Compassion. Meaning. Practice. The argument is cumulative. Each chapter earns the next. By the end, the conclusion should not feel like a surprise. It should feel like something you always knew and are now, finally, hearing said clearly. If it does, the book has done its work. Chapter 1, Why We Experience Ourselves as Separate. Most people move through life with a quiet, persistent feeling. I am here, and the world is there. I am inside my skin, behind my eyes, and everything else is outside me. Other people, other minds, the weather, the noise, the stars. Even in moments of closeness, holding someone, watching a sunset, hearing a piece of music that makes the hair on your arm stand up, the basic feeling remains. There is me, and there is not me. This feeling is so obvious that almost nobody questions it. It feels like a fact, not an interpretation. But there is one question worth asking, and it changes everything. Is separateness the fundamental truth about what we are? Or is it the way things look from where we stand? Asking this does not deny that you have a body, and I have a body. It does not deny that you have your thoughts, and I have mine. It does not deny anything practical. You can still tell your hand from a table. The question goes deeper than that. It asks whether the feeling of being separate tells us what we really are, or whether it is a tool that works so well we forgot it was a tool. Before we can talk about anything else, about God, about meaning, about how to treat each other, we have to start where everyone already stands, with the feeling of being separate, and why it is so convincing. The body draws a line. The simplest reason we feel separate is the body. Your nervous system is built for survival. It maps threats and opportunities. It knows what belongs to the organism and what does not. Hunger is felt here, in this stomach. Pain is felt here, in this body. Touch, balance, temperature. Every signal says the same thing. Protect this body. From the standpoint of staying alive, it makes perfect sense to split the world into me and not me. An animal that could not tell itself from its environment would not last long. Separateness is not a mistake. It is a survival strategy. But a strategy is not the same thing as the truth. A map is useful, but the map is not the territory. Something can work brilliantly without being the last word on what exists. The mind adds a story. On top of the body's line, the mind adds a narrator. Human beings do something remarkable. We tell ourselves a story about who we are. We take sensations, memories, fears, hopes, habits, and weave them into a character. This is me. This is my life. This is what I care about. This is what I'm afraid of. This story is useful. It creates continuity. It lets us learn, plan, take responsibility, find meaning. But it also strengthens the feeling that the self is a thing, a solid object moving through a world of other solid objects, separate from everything else. When people say I, most of them are not sure what they mean. A body, a personality, a mind, something behind the mind. They are not sure, because the sense of I arrives already assembled. It presents itself as obvious. Nobody asked whether it was accurate. Once that center is assumed, everything else becomes other. Language locks it in. If the body draws a line and the mind strengthens it, language makes it feel permanent. Language works by dividing things into named pieces. Tree, sky, person, stranger, mine, yours. These divisions are useful. Without them, you could not communicate, cooperate, or think clearly. But usefulness can quietly become confusion. Because language divides, it can make division seem like the fundamental nature of reality. We start treating named things as if they were truly separate entities rather than patterns within a single process. Think about the word ocean. It names something that sounds like one object, but the ocean is not a single object the way a stone is. It is currents, temperatures, pressures, tides, all moving together. The word makes it sound solid. It is not. Words are necessary, but they can suggest separateness where there is only connection. The group makes it bigger. Separateness does not stay personal. It becomes social. We form groups. We inherit identities. We draw lines between us and them. This is ancient, and it is not always harmful. Community can be nourishing. Shared culture creates belonging. The trouble starts when difference becomes distance, when not like me turns into less than me or nothing to do with me. At that point, empathy becomes optional. The inner life of the other person, their fear, their hope, their exhaustion, fades from view. Not because it is denied, because it is no longer felt. This usually does not announce itself as cruelty. It announces itself as reasonableness. They are different from us. They do not share our values. They chose this. These sentences are spoken calmly. That is precisely what gives them power. The leap nobody notices. Underneath the body, the story, the language, and the group, there is one move that almost nobody catches themselves making. We go from, I experience myself as separate, to I am separate at the fundamental level. That move feels natural, but it is not guaranteed. Experience is shaped by perspective. Perspective is limited by design. And limitation does not mean isolation. When you see a sunrise, it seems to be outside you, but the light enters your eyes, becomes electrical signals, becomes an experience. Where exactly is the line between inside and outside in that moment? When you breathe, where does the world end and you begin? In ordinary life, we shape each other constantly. Language, belief, identity. These are inherited before they are chosen. No one becomes who they are alone. A completely independent self is difficult to locate. So the first step is simply intellectual honesty. Separateness is an experience. It may not be the final word on what we are. Useful boundaries, not final ones. Boundaries exist. Bodies have skin. Concepts have definitions. These boundaries serve purposes, survival, coordination, communication. But useful boundaries are easily mistaken for final ones. A cell has a membrane, yet it exists only through exchange with its surroundings. A person has a body, yet exists only through relationship, biological, social, ecological. Boundaries organize what exists. They do not divide it into separate kinds of being. To make this intuitive rather than abstract, a simple image helps. You can draw a line in the sand without the sand becoming two different substances. The line is real. The sand is one. If that is true, if reality is one thing appearing as many rather than many things pretending to be one, then what follows is a correction. The word for that correction is unity. Not sameness, not the erasure of difference, just the recognition that distinction does not require disconnection. Once this is seen, the connection between what we believe about the world and how we treat each other becomes unavoidable. Chapter 2, The Cost of the Other. You have walked past a person and noticed that you stopped seeing them, not deliberately. The seeing just faded. They were there, and then they were a category. The homeless man, the wrong accent, the other side of the argument. The category arrived without your permission, and the person disappeared behind it. You know what this feels like. What begins as I am separate from the world, quietly, becomes we are separate from them. And when that happens, everything changes. The chapter that follows is an examination of that pattern. What happens when the feeling of separateness stops being a personal experience and becomes a structural assumption? Not an attack, an examination, and a cost. From difference to distance, people differ in temperament, language, culture, ability, belief, circumstance. These differences are not exceptions. They are the ordinary texture of life. Difference by itself carries no moral weight. The problem is not difference. The problem is what happens when difference stops being a description and becomes a definition. When, unlike me, quietly registers as apart from me at the fundamental level. This shift is rarely obvious. It does not feel like hostility. It feels like common sense. Attention narrows. Identification weakens. The inner life of the other person recedes. Not because it is denied, but because it is no longer in the foreground. Explanations emerge that create distance without open hostility. Differences of value, differences of choice, differences of responsibility. These explanations sound measured. They sound mature. And precisely because they sound measured, they do their work quietly. Difference becomes distance without anyone noticing the move. Indifference is enough. If the other person is deeply separate, their suffering becomes information rather than experience. You can acknowledge it without being touched by it. You can weigh it against your interests, your group's interests, your loyalty to an idea. This does not require hatred. Indifference is enough. Indifference is comfortable. It relieves moral tension. Over time, it becomes habit. It feels normal. It disappears from view. When belief outranks a relationship, the pattern intensifies when separateness is backed by ideology, especially ideology that claims the final word. When a belief system teaches that the most important relationship in a person's life is not with other people, but with an external authority, a quiet ranking appears. First, loyalty to the authority. Then, loyalty to the belief system. Then, loyalty to the group. Only then, the person standing in front of you. Once that ranking is accepted, extraordinary things become justifiable. If obedience is the highest good, harm can be reframed as duty. If belief is the highest virtue, doubt can be reframed as danger. This does not require malice. It requires certainty. History shows this over and over. Violence, justified by ideology, does not begin with cruelty. It begins with certainty. Righteousness. One of the most dangerous rewards of separateness is righteousness. Righteousness feels clean. It feels purposeful. It feels justified. It allows a person to harm without feeling harmful. Once someone is classified as deeply other, wrong, impure, dangerous, evil, the moral calculation shifts. Actions that would otherwise feel intolerable begin to feel necessary. This pattern is not limited to religion. It appears in political movements, national identities, racial hierarchies, moral crusades of every kind. The content changes. The structure stays the same. The structure is simple. I stand on the side of truth. You stand outside it. Therefore, what I do to you is justified. Separateness is what makes that structure stable. Costs that go unnoticed. The cost of separateness is not measured only in violence. Those are its most visible expressions. Its deeper cost is quieter. It reshapes how life is experienced, even when no one intends any harm. When separateness is the starting point, existence becomes something each person must manage alone. Connection becomes optional. Meaning becomes private. Security becomes something to defend rather than to share. The results show up in loneliness, even among others, in anxiety rooted in standing alone, in relationships treated as transactions rather than participation, in meaning outsourced to authority rather than discovered in lived connection. These do not require cruelty. They arise naturally from a world in which people are assumed to be separate and connection is secondary. If separateness is the most fundamental truth, these costs are simply the price of being alive. But if it is not the most fundamental truth, if it is a useful perspective mistaken for the final word, then everything built on it needs to be re-examined. That re-examination requires looking at one particularly influential idea, the most powerful, the most widespread, and the most consequential embodiment of separateness ever constructed, the idea that God is outside the world, not because religion is the enemy, but because no institution in history has done more to make separateness feel sacred. To question separateness, honestly, we must look at where it was given its deepest authority. Chapter 3, How God Became External. You have stood somewhere quiet, in a thunderstorm, beside the ocean, under a night sky, and felt something older than argument watching you. That feeling is where God began. Not above the world, inside it. Before asking what God is, it helps to understand where God was placed. And to understand this gently, because for many people, God is the most important relationship in their life. What follows is not an attack on that relationship. It is an examination of the architecture that surrounds it and what that architecture has cost. For much of early human history, the sacred was not experienced as distant. It was immediate. Nature was not a backdrop, but a living field, threatening, sustaining, mysterious. Storms, seasons, birth, illness, death. These were not events to be explained from outside. They were the world expressing itself. The sacred was woven into everything before it was lifted above everything. The movement toward an external God did not begin as a mistake. It began as an attempt to make sense of forces that felt overwhelming, from presence to power. As communities grew, so did their explanations. What once felt like a living field of forces slowly became personified. Thunder became a god. Fertility became a goddess. Time, death, war, wisdom, each was given a face and a will. Personification made the world relatable. It also made it governable. Once the sacred was imagined as having a will, it could command. Once it could command, it could be obeyed. And once obedience became central, the relationship shifted from participation to hierarchy. Over time, God moved upward, both in concept and in imagery. God came to be understood as above, beyond, outside the world. The sacred was no longer woven into existence. It ruled over it. This shift was gradual, but it came at a cost. The split. When God is placed outside the world, a division is introduced. Creator here, creation there. This seems intuitive. A potter is not a pot. An architect is not a building. But the analogy breaks exactly where it matters. A potter exists independently of the pot. But if God is understood as what everything depends on, as what is ultimate, then God cannot stand in the same relationship to the world as a maker to an object. A maker can walk away from what was made. If God is everywhere and in everything, there is nowhere to walk away to. Once God is imagined as a being among beings, even the highest one, something decisive happens. God becomes one thing, and everything else becomes another. Unity is replaced by distance. Participation is replaced by obedience. The sacred is no longer the ground of being. It becomes an object of belief. Authority replaces understanding. Once God is external, access to God must be mediated. Knowledge of God must come from somewhere. Scripture, doctrine, priesthood, tradition. This is not initially harmful. Communities need shared stories and structures. But authority has gravity. It pulls meaning upward. Truth becomes something delivered rather than discovered. Morality becomes something commanded rather than understood. The individual's task becomes alignment with an external will rather than clarity about what is actually going on. A person can now say, sincerely and without malice, my relationship with God is right. Therefore, my actions are justified. This does not require cruelty. It requires certainty. What was lost? Something essential was forgotten in this shift. Not deliberately, but structurally. Not by bad people. By all of us, gradually, over centuries. What was lost was the sense that being itself is sacred. Not by decree or belief, but by virtue of what it is. When God is external, the world becomes provisional. This life becomes a test rather than a participation. The sacred is postponed to heaven, to the afterlife, to judgment, rather than recognized as present. And when the sacred is postponed, suffering becomes easier to tolerate. Not because anyone chose to be cruel, because the architecture made a quiet suggestion. The real thing is elsewhere. This life is temporary. The suffering here is not the point. That suggestion was not invented by cruel people. It was inherited by kind ones. And kind people, holding that suggestion, found it just a little easier not to cause suffering, but to look past it. Not their own suffering, other people's. This is the structural cost, not cruelty. Something quieter, permission to look away. A quiet question. If God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-present, what exactly is God outside of? If nothing exists beyond everything, then placing God outside everything makes no sense. If God is everywhere, then God is not elsewhere. The external God does not need to be attacked. It quietly becomes incoherent under the weight of its own descriptions, toward immanence. Rejecting an external God does not mean reducing everything to dead matter. That is a false choice. The alternative is not atheism, it is immanence. Immanence does not deny God. It denies distance. It says that God is not separate from what exists, not standing apart as a ruler or a judge, identical with being itself, not as poetry, but as the simplest description that makes sense. If this is correct, the world is not something made by God and then left to run. It is the ongoing expression of what God is, and we, conscious beings within it, are not spectators. We are the world becoming aware of itself. Chapter 4, God and the Universe. If God is not external, a careful step is needed. What do we actually mean by the word God? This chapter does not ask for belief. It asks for clarity. What the word is trying to name, across cultures, across centuries, despite enormous differences in image and story. The word God has been used to point at something remarkably consistent, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present, the source of everything that exists, not dependent on anything else. These are not personality traits. They are attempts to name whatever is ultimate, whatever everything else depends on. Strip away the mythology, and what remains is not a character. It is a description of what must be true of whatever is fundamental to everything. You have stood outside on a clear night and looked up, not as a scientist, not as a theologian, as a person, and something in the scale of it, the depth, the silence, the way the light keeps arriving from places that no longer exist, made the word God stop feeling like an answer and start feeling like a name for what you were already inside. You were not praying. You were not thinking about a being. You were looking at something that includes you, something that does not need to be pointed to because you are inside it. That feeling has a name. The name is not the feeling, but the feeling is what the name is trying to carry. The role is already filled. Now, consider everything that exists, not as a collection of objects floating in empty space, but as the totality of all that is, including every process, every experience, every moment of awareness that arises within it. We call it the universe. Nothing exists outside the universe. Nothing acts independently of it. If something did exist beyond it, then the totality would not be the totality. It would be a subset of something larger. Whatever the word God is trying to name, ultimacy, non-dependence, the ground of everything, those roles are already occupied by the universe. What is being proposed here is not that God is a physical object. It is that the word God has always been pointing at something real, and that the something it points at does not require an outside. The gain, if this is accepted, is that sacredness is no longer postponed to an afterlife or delegated to an institution. It is where you are standing. The cost, if this is accepted, is that the specific person of traditional theism is gone. The trade is the trade. The book does not ask you to accept it. The book shows you what accepting it would mean. A common misunderstanding. At this point, a predictable objection. Are you saying God is just physical matter? No. That objection assumes the universe is limited to dead stuff. It is not. The universe includes matter and energy, space and time, process and structure, and awareness. Experience exists. You are having one right now. Awareness is not an addition from outside. It arises within what exists. To say that God and the totality of existence are the same thing is not to shrink the mystery. It is to put the mystery where it actually is. Not somewhere else, not above, not behind, but here. Why personhood keeps returning? Why is God so often imagined as a person? Because consciousness recognizes itself most easily in personal form. We are conscious, intentional beings. When we encounter something vast, powerful, and beyond our understanding, we instinctively give it a face and a will. This makes it relatable. It makes it emotionally accessible. But emotional accessibility is not the same as accuracy. The universe does not need a personality in order to be meaningful. A storm does not need intentions to be destructive. Existence does not need preferences in order to be real. Consciousness changes everything. If the universe were only machinery, calling it God would feel hollow. But the universe is not only machinery. It is something in which experience happens. You are a point at which the universe becomes aware of itself. Not fully, not globally, locally. When you look at the stars, everything that exists is, in that moment, looking at itself through your eyes. This is not poetry. It follows directly from the fact that you are made of the universe and conscious within it. You did not arrive in the universe. You came out of it. The universe is also you. Expression, not ownership. If everything that exists is one thing, then no individual can be God or the universe. In the complete sense, each of us is limited. Each has one perspective shaped by circumstance. But each person is an expression of the whole. Not separate from it. Not made apart from it. But arising within it and made of it. A wave is not separate from the ocean. But it is not the entire ocean. A person is not separate from the whole. But no person is the whole. This preserves unity without encouraging inflation. No one gets to claim a special position. Everyone participates on equal footing. What follows? Within this understanding, harm is no longer a violation of divine rules. It is a misunderstanding of what you are acting upon. To act violently against another person is to behave as though the world were divided against itself. Cruelty does not become forbidden. It becomes confused. It stops making sense. Compassion becomes the clearest response to a world understood accurately. The question that naturally follows is the one you are already asking. If everything is one, why does it look like many? If unity is the ground, where does all the difference come from? You cannot move forward without answering this, and neither can the argument. Chapter 5, Unity, Multiplicity, and the Illusion of Division. If the world is one thing, why does it look like many things? This is not a philosophical puzzle. It is the question that every honest reader has been holding since chapter 1. If separateness is not fundamental, what is all this difference? Where do the grains come from, if the desert is one? Unity that cannot account for difference is useless. A view that denies the obvious variety of the world does not deepen understanding. It abandons it. The task is not to deny diversity, individuality, or distinction. It is to understand how they arise and what they actually tell us. 1. Many. The world does not present itself as a single blank whole. It presents itself as countless forms. Stars and storms, people and places, thoughts and feelings, cultures and histories. These forms are not illusions. They are real patterns within a deeper unity. What is illusory? Is the conclusion that distinctness means disconnection. Multiplicity is obvious. The question is whether multiplicity requires separation. The desert. Consider a desert. A desert is real. You can stand in it. You can cross it. But what is it made of? Grains of sand, heat, wind, time, and the relations between them all. The desert is not an extra thing hovering above the sand. It is the pattern formed by the whole. Each grain is distinct. Each has a location, a shape, a history. No grain exists apart from the desert that produced it. The grain is real. The desert is real. The separation between them is not. This image does not deny individuality. It places individuality in context. The mistake is not noticing the grains. The mistake is concluding that the grains exist apart from the desert. The difference. Without this connection, unity does not mean sameness. Two people can share the same ground while differing completely in expression. Temperament, ability, belief, culture, circumstance, these vary endlessly. These variations are not problems to be solved. They are the way the world expresses itself through form. What unity denies is not difference, but absolute isolation. There is a line between being distinct and being separate. Distinct forms can belong to one process. Separate entities cannot. How division appears. The appearance of division arises when perspective is mistaken for position. Every aware being experiences the world from a particular point of view. That point of view is limited, local, centered. From inside it, everything else seems to be outside. But a point of view is not a separate piece of the world. It is the way the world appears from one location. A grain of sand cannot experience itself as the desert. The illusion forms when the mind concludes, because I experience from here, I must exist apart from what I experience. This is the same error as mistaking the map for the territory. The self, as process one of the strongest reinforcements of division, is the belief that the self is a thing, a solid, fixed object sitting behind the eyes. Look more carefully. Thoughts come and go. Emotions shift. Beliefs change. Even personality changes over time. What stays is not a static object, but a process, a continuity of awareness shaped by memory, perspective, and relationship. The self is not an object moving through the world. It is a pattern occurring within it. A process can be real without being separate. A whirlpool is real. It is not separate from the river. Equal in kind. If every aware being is an expression of the same whole, then equality is not a policy. It is a fact about what we are. This equality does not depend on intelligence, morality, belief, or behavior. It comes before all of them. Differences in ability, role, and responsibility remain. But no one is closer to the source than anyone else. No form is more essential. The connection to ethics. Once unity and difference are shown to coexist, the connection between what the universe is and how we treat each other becomes direct. If people are not ultimately separate, then treating them as though they were, with indifference, contempt, or violence, is not merely unkind. It is inaccurate. It misreads what is being acted on. The next step is to understand the individual clearly, not as an isolated atom, not as a dissolved nothing, as something specific. Chapter 6. What a person is, you have watched the child you know become recognizably more themselves over a year. Something in the shape of them stabilized while the body kept changing. That is the shape of what a person is. If unity and difference can coexist without contradiction, the individual must be understood clearly. The concern is natural. Does understanding the world as one thing diminish the importance of the self? It does not. It locates the self accurately. Limitation is not insignificance. A person is limited. This is not controversial. Each exists at a particular place and time. Each has limited knowledge, limited power, a limited lifespan. No one sees the whole. But limitation does not mean insignificance. A single word can alter a life. A single note can transform a piece of music. A single act of kindness can change the direction of a day, a year, a family. A single decision made by one person in one room can ripple through generations. Limitation does not negate meaning. It makes meaning possible. To be specific in form is not to be lesser in worth. It is to be capable of the one thing the whole cannot do on its own. See itself from here, from this angle, through these particular eyes, the wave and the ocean. A wave does not own the ocean. It does not control it or understand it in its entirety, but it is not separate from it. its existence is the ocean appearing in a particular way, at a particular moment. A wave is not less real because it belongs to the ocean. It is not diminished by being an expression rather than an independent thing. A person does not own the world, truth, or God. Awareness does not grant authority over the whole. It grants participation within it. This preserves dignity without encouraging inflation. No one stands at the center. Everyone participates. And participation is not a lesser role. It is the only role there is. Awareness as local disclosure. The world is not merely something that exists. It is something in which experience occurs. Aware beings are the points at which the world discloses itself. Not globally, not completely, but locally. Each is a perspective, not a center. Each is a window, not the building. There is no privileged position from which the whole is seen. There are only countless partial views, each revealing the universe from a particular expression in space and time, through particular conditions, with particular limitations. We are all grains of sand. This is not a weakness. This is how expression works. A story told from every angle simultaneously would be noise. A story told from one angle clearly is a story. Why? Individuality persists. If unity were all that mattered, individuality would be unnecessary. But individuality persists because it serves expression. Different perspectives allow different experiences. Different abilities allow different responses. Different histories allow different understandings. The variety is not a defect. It is the richness. Unity without difference would be static. A perfect mirror with nothing to reflect. A difference without unity would be chaos. A pile of fragments with no connection. The world exhibits neither extreme. It exhibits both. Held together. Identity. Without isolation. Identity. Within this view becomes relational rather than absolute. A person is defined not in isolation, but by position, relation, ability, and limitation within a shared world. This does not dissolve identity. It clarifies it. The self is not a sealed container. It is a living node in a wider field. Once this is seen clearly, humility stops being a moral demand. It becomes a recognition. No perspective is final. No viewpoint exhausts what there is. No belief gives access to the whole. At the same time, this does not undermine confidence. You can speak clearly from a limited position without claiming the last word. Meaning survives. A concern arises. If individuality is not the fundamental layer, does meaning collapse? It does not. Meaning does not come from separation. It comes from relevance, from participating in something larger than yourself. A role matters because it is not the whole. A choice matters because it changes a shared world. A gesture matters because it reaches beyond the person who makes it. Meaning survives unity because unity makes consequence unavoidable. What you do touches others. What touches others touches the whole. And the whole includes you. Chapter 7. Free will, power, and responsibility. You have already made a choice by reading this far. Something in you chose to keep going. Not because you were commanded, not because the outcome was predetermined, because something in what you read resonated and you responded. That response, the capacity to consider, to weigh, to adjust, is the only freedom that has ever existed, and it is enough. This chapter does not ask whether you are free. You just demonstrated that you are. It asks what freedom looks like once separateness is no longer the starting point. The answer matters. Without some form of choice, ethics is meaningless. If you cannot choose, you cannot be responsible. And if you cannot be responsible, kindness is just something that happens to occur. The false choice. You may have heard that the question of free will comes down to two options. Either you are a completely independent origin of your actions, or everything is determined and choice is an illusion. Both options rely on the same mistake, the idea that freedom requires independence from the world. But nothing stands outside the world. Nothing ever has. A wave is not free because it is separate from the ocean. It is free as the ocean, expressing itself in a particular way, at a particular moment, causes and participation. Every action has causes. Biology, psychology, culture, history, circumstance, all shape what we do. Acknowledging this does not eliminate choice. It places choice in context. A person is neither an uncaused cause nor a passive effect. A person is a point at which causes are processed, reflected on, and expressed in a new way. Think of it this way. A rock rolling downhill has no choice. It follows gravity. A person walking downhill can stop, turn around, sit down, or change direction. Not because the person is free from physics, but because the person reflects, considers, responds. That capacity, reflection, consideration, response, is not decorative. It is not a feeling layered on top of a machine. It is a real way in which what happens next is shaped by understanding, by reasons, by the anticipation of consequences. Choice is not freedom from causes. It is the capacity to shape how causes are taken up and expressed. This is not a weaker version of freedom. It is the only version that makes sense. Freedom as responsiveness. Freedom is not unlimited choice. It is responsiveness. An aware being can reflect on impulses, imagine alternatives, anticipate consequences, and adjust. This capacity varies. It can be developed or damaged. It is not all or nothing. Freedom grows with awareness. Not because awareness removes causes, but because it expands the range of possible responses. A person who understands more, sees more, and pays more attention is freer than a person who does not. Not because they have broken free of the world, but because they engage with it more fully. Power is relational. Power is the ability to influence what happens within a shared world. In a connected world, power is never held in isolation. It flows through situations, structures, and relationships. To exercise power is to alter the conditions under which others act, including yourself. A parent shapes a child. A teacher shapes a room. A policy shapes a city. None of them act alone, and none of them act without consequence. This means power carries responsibility by its very nature, not responsibility as blame. Responsibility as the recognition that your actions alter what is real for others. Why unity deepens responsibility. This point often surprises. If people were truly isolated, responsibility would be arbitrary. Your actions would end with you. Harm would be a private transaction. Kindness would be optional generosity toward a stranger who has nothing to do with you. But in a connected world, actions travel. They ripple outward. They alter patterns. They shape the lives of people you will never meet. A decision made in one room can close a door in another. Not metaphorically, literally. The world is that connected. Because your actions touch more than you, not less. Responsibility deepens rather than disappears. Unity does not excuse harm. It explains why harm cannot be contained. Moral development as clarity. Within this view, moral growth is not obedience to increasingly strict rules. It is the gradual increase of clarity. As understanding deepens, behavior adjusts. Harm becomes harder to justify. Not because it is forbidden, but because it no longer aligns with what you understand about the world. You do not need a new rule for every situation. You need clearer sight. The rest follows. This is not moral heroism. It is coherence between understanding and action. And coherence, not obedience, is what holds. Chapter 8. Why compassion is rational. You have watched someone be cruel and felt something in your chest contract. Not moral disapproval. Something older. Something structural. By this point, the ground has shifted. We have not issued commands. We have not appealed to authority or invoked fear or reward. We have examined what the world looks like when separateness is no longer treated as the final truth. This chapter draws the conclusion that follows. If the world is one thing, if aware beings are expressions of that one thing, and if actions travel through a shared field, then compassion is not a moral preference. It is the clearest response to the world understood accurately. Rules and understanding. Most moral systems start with rules. Do this. Do not do that. Obey this authority. Avoid this punishment. Seek this reward. Rules can regulate behavior. They rarely change understanding. They can be followed mechanically, resisted strategically, or ignored when inconvenient. Understanding works differently. When a situation is understood clearly, certain actions simply stop making sense. You do not need a rule to stop you putting your hand in fire. The nature of fire is enough. Compassion works the same way. It is not commanded. It follows from seeing clearly, harm as confusion. If the other person is fundamentally separate from you, harm can be rationalized. It can be weighed, justified, delayed, outsourced. It becomes a strategic decision. But if the other person is not separate in essence, if you and they are expressions of the same world, then harm is not a strategy. It is a confusion, a misreading of what you are acting on. It is not merely that harm is wrong. It is that harm does not make sense. To harm another person while sharing the same world is like your left hand attacking your right. The hands feel separate. The body is one. The damage does not stay local. It travels through the shared structure and returns to the one who caused it. Not as punishment, but as consequence. The cost of cruelty. Cruelty is expensive. Not only morally, structurally. Cruelty fractures trust. It escalates conflict. It multiplies suffering. Even when it seems effective in the short term, it carries costs that accumulate in broken relationships, in damaged communities, in the slow erosion of the conditions that allow people to thrive. Kindness, by contrast, is efficient. It is low-friction behavior. It reduces resistance. It stabilizes systems. It preserves the conditions under which everyone, including you, can function. This is not sentimentality. It is observation. The world works better when people are not tearing it apart. Compassion without softness. Compassion is often misunderstood as weakness, as letting things slide, as tolerating harm. That misunderstanding arises when compassion is framed as self-sacrifice imposed by moral pressure. Here, compassion is something else entirely. It is clarity applied to action. It does not require liking. It does not require agreement. It does not require tolerance of harm. It requires recognition. Recognition that the other person is not outside the world that includes you. That their experience is as real as yours. that what happens to them is not happening elsewhere. It is happening here, in the same shared structure that you inhabit, boundaries, without contempt. A common objection. Does compassion mean allowing harm? No. Compassion does not eliminate boundaries. It informs them. A surgeon cuts to heal. A parent says no to protect. A community restrains to preserve safety. Boundaries remain necessary. Consequences remain necessary. Protection remains necessary. What changes is the logic behind them. Boundaries stop being expressions of dominance or moral superiority and become expressions of care for the whole, which includes the person being restrained and the person doing the restraining, and everyone affected by the outcome. The disappearance of moral superiority. One of the quiet benefits of this view is the dissolution of moral hierarchy. If harm arises from confusion rather than from inherent evil, then moral superiority becomes incoherent. There is no elevated position from which one stands apart and looks down. This does not excuse harm. It changes the response. The appropriate response shifts from condemnation to correction, from hatred to firmness, from punishment to restoration where possible. Seriousness remains. Cruelty in the response does not. The only mode that holds. Once the world is understood as connected rather than divided, the available ways of engaging with other people narrow. Exploitation becomes unstable. It depends on a separation that does not exist, and it generates consequences that cannot be contained. Indifference becomes hard to maintain. It requires not seeing what is in front of you. Cruelty stops making sense. It damages the structure you live in. What is left is not sainthood. It is consistency. Compassion and kindness are not ideals draped over the world from above. They are what remains when the world is no longer misread. What stands behind this? Everything you have just read. Every observation about separateness. Every argument about compassion. Every image of grains and deserts and waves. It's not just philosophy. It is derived. Behind this book stands a formal body of work that derives everything said here from one premise. One record exists through four axioms, using the same mathematics that describes how light travels, how gravity bends space, and how atoms hold together. The derivation has been tested, published, and equipped with 554 specific conditions under which it fails. It is called the 420 Code, and it is free forever at the420code.org. What you may not expect is how far the derivation goes. It does not stop at be kind. It continues into the geometry of what kindness actually looks like in practice. Here is a glimpse of what the formal work contains. Every person has a corridor, the set of futures still reachable from where they stand right now. A young person with health, savings, and choices has a wide corridor. A person in debt, in crisis, with no support, has a narrow one. The corridor is not a feeling. It is a measurement. The geometry of what is still possible, given the energy you have and the constraints you face. The corridor narrows on its own. Without effort, without maintenance, possibilities close. Drift is the default. This is not pessimism. It is physics. The same physics that says a cup of tea cools if you do not keep heating it. There is a surface, a boundary, beyond which recovery is impossible. Cross it, and certain futures are gone. Not because you failed, because the mathematics of your situation has closed. Addiction crosses this surface. Terminal debt crosses it. certain relationships cross it. The boundary is real. It is not psychology. It is geometry. Here is a result that changes how you think about discipline. Steady, calm effort preserves your corridor more effectively than the same amount of effort applied in panic. Double the correction, more than double the cost. Discipline is not a virtue. It is a theorem. Patience is not a personality trait. It is structural efficiency. And here is the result that connects everything back to this book. When two people are connected, when your corridor depends on mine and mine depends on yours, cooperative coupling expands the space for both. Kindness is not a sacrifice. It is the behavior that keeps both corridors open. Cruelty contracts them. Indifference lets them narrow. The geometry does not care about your intentions. It measures your effect. This is what stands behind "Don't be a cunt, be kind." Not a slogan. Not a preference. A geometric result about coupled systems under irreversible drift, derived from the same axioms that derive the speed of light and the mass of the proton. The gentle argument of this book and the formal architecture of the 420 code say the same thing. This book says it in words you can feel. The formal work says it in words you can test. Both are available, both are free, both are honest about the conditions under which they break. If what you have read so far has resonated, the formal work will not contradict it. It will show you why it is not just beautiful. It is necessary. Chapter 9. Meaning without dogma. When morality no longer rests on command, a deeper question arises. Where does meaning come from? For many people, meaning has been tied to belief. Purpose was given, not found. Direction was prescribed, not discovered. Take away the source, and it can feel as though meaning itself dissolves. This chapter argues the opposite. Meaning does not disappear when external authority falls away. It changes location. Imposed meaning and lived meaning. Dogma provides meaning by decree. It tells you what matters, why it matters, and how to pursue it. This offers certainty. It also creates dependence. When meaning is imposed from outside, it survives only as long as belief does. One serious doubt, one encounter with real suffering that the system cannot explain, and it can shatter overnight. Lived meaning works differently. It does not arrive fully formed. It emerges through engagement, through consequence, through relationship. It is not handed down. It is built. It is earned. And because it is earned, it does not break when the weather changes, meaning as consequence. In a connected world, meaning is not a prize for obedience. It is a consequence of participation. Actions matter because they change a shared world. Words matter because they shape understanding. Attention matters because it determines what is sustained and what is neglected. Meaning shows up wherever impact exists. This makes meaning more demanding, not less. There is no external authority to defer to. No ledger balancing effort against reward. There is only the fact that what you do matters, because it ripples through the lives of others. What remains is responsibility. The clearing. When imposed meaning falls away, there is often a void. The structures that once organized life, the rules, the authorities, the promises of reward and threat of punishment, are gone. The emptiness can feel like loss. It is not loss. It is preparation. Think of a forest floor after a fire. The old growth is gone. What remains looks barren. But the clearing is where new things grow. The emptiness is not the absence of meaning. It is the absence of borrowed meaning. What grows in its place belongs to you. Not because you invented it, but because you found it through living rather than through obedience. Why struggle does not negate meaning. A common assumption is that meaning requires reassurance, that life must be guided by a higher plan in order to matter. But struggle does not negate meaning. It reveals the conditions you are working within. Limited beings navigating limited conditions will always encounter resistance. Growth happens through negotiation with limits, not through freedom from them. Meaning is not found in the absence of difficulty, but in the quality of engagement with it. Struggle matters because it is shared. Suffering matters because it occurs within the same world. Effort matters because it shapes what happens to others. Why nihilism fails? Nihilism says, without external meaning, nothing matters. This conclusion follows only if meaning must come from outside. If meaning arises from within, from consequence, from connection, from the fact that your actions alter a shared world, then nihilism loses its footing. Things matter because they affect experience. They matter because they shape futures. They matter because they contribute to or undermine the conditions under which life can flourish. Meaning is not fragile. It is structural. It does not collapse when belief wavers. It is embedded in consequence. It was there before anyone named it. Purpose without prescription. Purpose is often imagined as a task assigned from above. But purpose can also be understood as direction emerging from circumstances. A caregiver's purpose arises from dependence encountered. A teacher's purpose arises from curiosity met. A builder's purpose arises from structures needed. Purpose is not announced. It is recognized. It is local, dynamic, and responsive. It evolves as conditions change and deepens as understanding grows. The seriousness of ordinary life. Without dogma, life becomes quieter. There is no cosmic audience watching from above. No final judgment resolving all ambiguity. No exemption from consequence. What is left is ordinary life. Serious, not because it is observed, but because it is real. Because what you do this afternoon in this room with this person matters. Not because someone is keeping score, but because the world is one thing and your actions move through it. You act carefully, not out of fear, but out of understanding. Chapter 10, Living Without the Other. Nothing new needs to be added at this point. The work of this book has been clarification, not instruction. What remains is not a doctrine to follow, but a way of standing in the world once certain assumptions have quietly fallen away. To live without the other does not mean to deny difference, conflict, or disagreement. It means to stop granting difference a deeper status than it deserves. The end of distance. When separateness is no longer the starting point, something subtle changes. People are no longer encountered first as categories: believer, skeptic, ally, enemy, stranger, but as aware beings occupying different positions within the same world. Difference remains. Distance dissolves. This does not eliminate evaluation or judgment. It changes their basis. You respond to what is present rather than to what you have decided the other person is. Listening. One of the earliest practical consequences is not better argument, but better listening. When the other person is not treated as an opposing force, disagreement loses its threat. Identity no longer needs to be defended through domination. Listening becomes possible without surrender. This does not guarantee agreement. It guarantees engagement without destruction, conflict without annihilation. Conflict does not disappear. Interests still clash. Values still diverge. Harm still occurs. What disappears is the logic of annihilation, the belief that the problem exists because the other person exists. Conflict becomes something to be navigated rather than won. The goal shifts from victory to resolution, from dominance to stability. Firm action remains possible. Hatred becomes unnecessary. Action without righteousness. Perhaps the most liberating consequence of this view is the dissolution of righteousness. Righteousness depends on opposition. It requires someone to be deeply wrong so that someone else can be deeply right. Once fundamental otherness dissolves, righteousness loses its footing. You can act decisively without inflation. You can set boundaries without contempt. You can oppose harm without erasing the personhood of the one who caused it. Strength remains. Cruelty does not. Responsibility becomes local. Living without the other does not involve saving the world. It involves attending to what is within reach. How do my words alter this conversation? How do my choices shape the situation? How does my behavior affect the people it touches? This keeps responsibility grounded. It prevents both paralysis and grandiosity. It replaces the fantasy of moral perfection with the practice of moral attention. Compassion without performance. When compassion arises from understanding rather than from identity, it no longer needs to be displayed. There is no audience to convince, no virtue to signal, no moral status to maintain. Compassion becomes ordinary, expressed through tone, through restraint, through timing, through attention. It does not announce itself. It functions. The quiet disappearance of hatred. Hatred requires distance. It requires an object that can be reduced, fixed, and opposed without remainder. When the other person is no longer other, in the most fundamental sense, hatred has nowhere stable to land. Anger may still arise. Grief may still arise. Firm action may still be needed. But hatred fades. Not because it is suppressed, because it no longer makes sense. Failure without despair. Even with clarity, mistakes will be made. Harm will still occur. Understanding does not grant perfection. What changes is how failure is held. Failure becomes feedback rather than condemnation. It becomes an opportunity for adjustment rather than a reason for self-destruction. This preserves continuity. It allows learning. It makes the next attempt possible. A life that makes sense. To live without the other is not to become a saint. It is to become coherent. Coherent between understanding and action. Coherent between self-interest and the shared world. Coherent between power and responsibility. This is not an achievement to be unlocked. It is not a permanent state to be attained. It is a practice. A daily, ordinary practice of seeing clearly and acting accordingly. Some days it holds. Some days it does not. The practice does not require perfection. It requires honesty. The grains of sand are still distinct. Each has a shape, a position, a history. The desert is still one. Not perfectly, not ideologically, but honestly. And honestly is enough. You already knew this. You knew it before you opened this book. You knew it when you were small, before the layers were added. Before the body drew its line, before the mind built its story, before language locked it in, before the group made it bigger. You knew it in every moment of real closeness, in every act of genuine kindness that required no reason, in every flash of recognition when you looked at another person and saw behind the surface something that was not other. You knew it. You just did not have the words. Now you do. Don't be a cunt. Be kind. The formal kill switches for the claims in this book appear in the companion volumes and at the 420code.org, where the structural work is load-bearing. This book is the door. The structural work is inside the building. This work is published for free forever. The 420code.org series. The 420 Code catalog, The Five Doors. Title, The Illusion of the Other. Subtitle, The Unnoticed Leap That Changes Everything Without Asking for Faith. Medium Structural Philosophy and Ethical Derivation. Artist, G. This work is copyleft. You are free to download, print, share, and distribute. You are not free to alter the source. Keep the signal clean. Don't be a cunt. Be kind. The 420code.org. Copyleft 2026. The Lifestyle 1980 805 2025 1225.